And before we get started today, I'd like to just offer a disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear on this program are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. Joining me for this first segment, I wanted to talk about the anime music video competition at Anime Expo, and so I asked Michael Underwood, the director of entertainment for the SPJA, and specifically the guy in charge of the anime music video contest there, to join me. Thank you, Michael, for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sure thing. So I want to get right into this because I'm extremely curious about this, and somebody already accused me of trying to stir up shit or something just by asking questions about it, but this is a completely new thing. You've introduced a major cash prizes into the anime music video competition and the cosplay, but I don't think I've ever heard of this happening before. And right off the top, how did you come to this decision, and what's the reasoning behind it? What's the thinking?
Well, the idea wasn't actually mine. It was the idea of the board and the CEO of SPJA, who put on Anime Expo. The idea is, this is our 20th Anime Expo, so we've been going since 92. And the big theme for this 20th event was Year of the Fan. And they wanted to give something back to the fans. So one of the ideas they came up with was to introduce cash prizing to the major contests, which are the Masquerade, which is our most attended contest or event, the AMVs, which is our second most attended, and AX Idol will be getting a cash prize as well. I think I probably just jumped the gun on marketing by saying that, but oh well.
Well, I don't think it would come as any major surprise. That's the one I've always been a little surprised there was no cash prize on. But okay, so this is intended to sort of give something back to the fans.
Exactly.
It's not an insubstantial amount of money. The winners, the grand prize is like $2,500, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, best of show is $2,500, and each of the individual subcategories. So we've got drama, action, comedy, AMTV Pro, and we just added the fun / OVA category, which is where like parodies and stuff go. Each of those, the best of for each category gets $1,500.
Nice. Okay. Now, I have to admit, the minute I saw this, it really got me thinking, because I thought, okay, these communities, and you don't have to comment on this, but the AMV community and the cosplay community, let's not beat around the bush, are pretty drama-ful. Mm-hmm. They're contentious, these people. I'm sure they're lovely people. I'm sure that's really fun communities, but all I ever hear about is the crazy drama that goes on in those communities. And so I have to wonder, doesn't adding money to that competition seem like just throwing fire on a pile of greasy rags? I mean,
that appears to have been partially the case.
Okay.
Originally, we didn't expect, there has been a surprising amount of negative reaction to it. We weren't expecting that. We were quite taken aback by it. Because as I said, our motivation was giving something back to the fans. And you're right. Most of your, for lack of a better term, niche areas, individual subsets of the fandom, they are somewhat drama ridden, or drama prone, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just because the people who are in them are extremely passionate.
Yeah. They're passionate fans, and that's,
and, you know, passion breeds drama sometimes.
Yeah.
So, we weren't expecting the negative kickback we got from it. Obviously, this is probably going to help color whether or not there's a cash prize next year.
Right.
But the main focus was, we didn't see it as adding fuel to the fire. We didn't even anticipate that it would add fuel to the fire. We thought, hey, awesome. We're rewarding these guys for their hard work, showing them that we genuinely appreciate them, especially in the case of the AMV contest, because for the longest time, you know, there wasn't a lot of support behind it. And recently we've been trying to give it more respect, as it were.
Now, in terms of the negative reaction to it, the most common thing that I've seen is, first of all, the contest already exists in this giant legal gray area.
Yes,
you guys pay licensing fees.
Yes, we
that,
do.
That sort of get you around that fact. But, you know, these are not legal creations. And not only that, a lot of people argue that, okay, you're taking someone else's TV show and someone else's song and mashing them together. That's not really, you know, it's not a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So people are sort of, so now you're going to give them cash in exchange for their illegal activities. Now, that's not necessarily my take on it, but I've seen that thrown around a lot. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I don't proclaim to be one. I don't pretend to be one. I don't play one on TV. Mm-hmm. But it's the legalities of it are not a new concept. You know, it's so I'm mixing my sentences. I apologize. Okay. AMVs themselves, in one form or another, have been around forever. I mean, Star Trek cons have had the sci-fi Star Trek equivalent of them going back to, you know, the early 80s. You know, their fan-made videos have been around forever. In fact, I remember in high school, I saw, now just to date myself a bit, I graduated high school in 85. So we're talking like 82, 83 here.
Okay.
I saw a video where someone had taken the Mission Impossible theme and edited it to a couple scenes from Star Trek. Specifically, it was like Kirk and the one silver slave girl thing. Okay. And they made a music video out of that. So the concept of AMVs, as it were, have been around forever. I've heard arguments for and against it. There's the legal gray zone, as you said, and the biggest argument I've heard for it has been the quote unquote fair use argument. There's also the whole, yeah, they're not a painting, but they are. That doesn't, the fact that they're not, you know, a Picasso or a fine piece of art in the sense of, you know, paintings, that doesn't lessen them as an art, because there's a lot of skill and a lot of creativity that goes into making them. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, like any other art form, you know, you've got your awesome pieces of work and you've got your, oh my God, what the hell were you thinking? My 2-year-old could do better than this, and everything in between.
Right.
So
I think it's just, I think for some people, it's difficult to justify someone getting thousands of dollars for creating an AMV. I think that's just a sentiment that's roaming around out there.
And it's one I've been doing my best to address to the best of my ability. You know, like I said, I can't refer to legality because I'm not a lawyer. But. Right.
So in your mind, basically, you guys wanted to reward all the hard work that these people put into it with more than just a statue. And this was the thing you came up with.
Exactly. Well, yeah, it was our way of saying thank you for their long support. I mean, you know, the contest, anyone who's followed the AMV contest at Anime Expo has seen it go up. And it's like a roller coaster, you know. It's had its highs, it's had its lows, and it's had its mid-grounds. And it's our way of saying thank you to those who have supported the convention and supported the contest all these years. I mean, AMVs are what got me into Anime Expo. My right. first time coming to Anime Expo in 95 was I was still in college for taking my news classes and editing classes. And I created what I thought was an awesome AMV. And I'm like, oh God, I got to share this. They have a contest. Let's go. Mm-hmm. You know? And I entered, and I'll be honest, it was crap, but, you know, that's what brought me to Anime Expo. And then 2 years later in 98, I entered again, and a friend of mine, a guy who I was in a band with at the time, actually says, hey, you're here. I need a staffer. Come work. And that's what got me into working at Anime Expo in the first place. So AMVs are a deeply personal thing to me as well.
Yeah, it's always been a big part of AX.
And we wanted to thank them for their long-term support.
And unfortunately, the way that manifests is thanking the fans for their long-term support. One guy gets a couple thousand bucks for making a music video.
Well, yeah,
like 10 guys.
But, yeah. You know, it's at its heart, it is a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a competition, you're going to have your best of shows, your best of categories. So yeah, you're right, but it is a competition. There's got to be a winner in the competition.
Right.
One of the things we have done to try and further include, I mean, is the only, there are more categories than those that are getting the cash prizes.
Mm-hmm.
But only the awards that are determined by the audience are the ones that we're giving the cash prizes to.
It's only audience award then.
Exactly. So like the audience is the one who determines the best of categories and the best of shows. So those are the ones we're giving the prize, that particular prizing to. We also have a special judges award, a creators award, and a staff favorite.
And those aren't cash.
Those are not cash prizes.
Okay.
For wanting to prevent, the reason we didn't attach cash prizes to those is wanting to avoid drama.
Good job.
That's okay. But we wanted to avoid drama, and we also wanted to remove any potential chance of bias.
Yeah.
By letting the audience make the decision, there's no way someone could come back and say, you guys, you know, you made my video lose. No, the audience made the selection.
You still get that anyway, though, right? Like, the audience is biased.
To an extent. You know, it's, I always get that. Why wasn't my video selected?
People didn't like it as much as the other one?
Yeah, you know, it's, it is what it is.
Okay, well, that's, I mean, because I was, you know, I was about to say, the end result of this is basically message board bitching after the fact, and so do you think that the excitement created by the cash prizes and the hopefully maybe the incentive to really bust your ass and create something amazing for the contest, do you think that will outweigh the potential forums? Well, it's not potential. People are going to complain no matter what, but the backlash you might get online.
Well, people are already complaining. But
yeah.
It's our hope that that's what's going to happen. You know, and our hope is that that they'll look at the end of the day and they'll see it as what it was, you know, our attempt to give thanks. And there's going to be drama, but I'd say so far, while we've gotten some negative responses, I think the positive responses have outweighed the negatives. I've gotten far more positive responses than, you know, those that have been screaming about, oh my God, it's the end of all things, AMV, how dare you? And I've actually gotten that. Yeah. I actually had one person come up, you know, one person ping me on the forums going, you know, why the hell are you attaching a cash prize? You're going to destroy AMVs everywhere. And it's like, wow, dude, the contest hasn't even happened yet. Okay, I'm sorry you feel that way, but, you know, we're not out to destroy, you know, we're not trying to push the nuclear button here.
Yeah. That's yeah. I mean, and that's inevitable. Of course, that's going to happen. But
yeah,
I mean,
every year I've been, you know, I've only been running the contest with help. I mean, I haven't done it solo. But you know, I've only been part of the team running the contest for the last 3 years. And you know, when we took over, there was drama.
Mm-hmm.
And it took time for us to prove ourselves. That we were taking it seriously, that we were going to meet the deadlines, that we were going to make sure the show went off on time, stuff like that. And we've managed to prove in that. And as we've proven ourselves over the years, we've gotten more support. But, you know, as you said earlier, there's always going to be somebody. There's always going to be some people who don't agree with our viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their right.
Of course. So overall, you think that the effect of doing this is more positive than potentially negative?
I hope so.
Okay, so it is really an experiment.
Yes.
Okay, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. So I also wanted to ask you, how do you think AMVs have changed over the last, like, 5 years? Obviously, with media creation becoming something virtually anyone can do in their house, mm-hmm. With the right software, you know, AMVs have changed dramatically, I think, since, you know, the days of two VCRs.
That's where I started.
I used to make those too. I had my two VCRs stacked up and I tried to make Escaflowne videos. But
mine was actually Queensryche and Akira.
There you go. I mean, I've noticed things have really changed dramatically. Is the competition itself more now a video editing showcase, do you think? You know, how sophisticated you are with the software?
Yes and no. In one of our categories, for sure, that's it. That's why we took the AMTV category and made it the AMTV Pro category.
Mm.
Is we wanted a spot where folks who wanted to do all the fancy tricks, you know, not just I've got After Effects. Let's use every transition we can possibly imagine. And we get those every year. We get somebody. Last year, we got a series of videos from one user who we're convinced it was his entire repertoire. You know, it's like, we think he got the Adobe Classroom in a book for Premiere.
Mm-hmm.
It's at chapter one, the cut. And his first video was like that. Chapter two, wipes and trans. And you could literally count the chapters as this guy's progression was going. And by the end, he had a great video. I mean, the number, his eighth entry was fantastic. We're like, wow, this guy just went through the whole book. But to more, you know, directly answer your question, things have radically changed from the days when people were sitting with, you know, in your case, two decks stacked on top of each other. In my case, I was doing it at my college, when, you know, a couple of Panasonic 570s linked together.
Mm-hmm.
And going from linear to nonlinear has changed things dramatically. The ease of access of the software, of the media, and the power of the hardware has made it insanely easier from a technical standpoint. But, you know, technical tools, fancy programs and stuff do not a good video make.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to have the eye, you have to have the ability, the skill, and the composition. And that's what makes a good video. Has the quality improved over the years? Oh, drastically. I would say significantly so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mashup, but it still takes, you still have to be a creative person in order to make an effective one.
Exactly.
You know,
and that's the key word, is it an effective one? Because, you know, every year we get the spectrum. We get people who have obviously put a lot of time in their work, and then we get other people who are just like, oh, look, I've got Linkin Park, and I've got DBZ. Yeah. Holy crap, these would make a great video, and just randomly slap stuff together.
Do you still get a lot of Linkin Park?
We, for a while there, we were getting a lot of Linkin Park Z videos, as we refer to them. But they've actually gone down. We haven't gotten as much Linkin. Every year we get at least two or three Linkin Parks.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not getting nearly as many as we used to. And they're not always linked with either Ava or Dragon Ball Z anymore. They're starting to branch out.
Okay, now maybe Naruto sneaks in there.
Yeah.
What is the big thing? What do you get a lot of?
I think the biggest thing we get lately, it's been in phases. Last year seemed to be the year of Code Geass.
Okay.
Well, actually, let me phrase that: Code Geass and Gurren Lagann.
Okay.
And backtracking on the other thing with the Linkin Ball Z videos, every now and then we still get some really good ones that fit in there. But it's they're not as overused as they used to be. But back to what we get the most. Yeah, last year was, what was there? I'm trying to think if there was an overwhelming. Code Geass has been one of the big ones. For a while there, it's been interesting to see how the trends go, because you can like watch the AMVs and you can see trends and who's watching what. So for a while there, you were getting a lot of Naruto, and then that kind of phased over into getting a lot of the
I know Death Note.
When Gurren Lagann came out, we started getting a lot of those. And then Code Geass came out, and now Gurren Lagann and Code Geass are going head to head. I honestly expect now that the new, now that they're redoing the Ava movies,
mm-hmm.
I fully expect this year we're going to get some incredible Ava videos.
Yeah, yeah. And any particular artists you're hearing a lot of?
Let's see. Musically, they're pretty all over the map. We usually get, like the last couple years ago, oh, there's this one song, and it's the lyric is like making my way downtown. It's got the piano before it. I don't remember the name of the song, but we got like six videos to this song. And by the time we're like, oh my God, it's this song. No, not again.
I think this year you might get a lot.
Romeo and Juliet. That's the name of the song. Oh, that's the one we had last year. The Taylor Swift song last year. We got Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, okay.
My fiance in the background was reminding me.
Okay.
You know, we got the Romeo and Juliet video song like three or four times last year.
Wow.
And what's funny is one of the videos that submitted it that I thought was really funny was somebody tried to make it yaoi using Kingdom Hearts 2, Roxas, and the red spiky-haired guy. I don't remember his name.
Right. Yeah.
That one was actually very funny.
I predict this year you're going to get a lot of CeeLo Green, maybe Justin Bieber.
Yeah. Oh God, I'm not. One of the reasons I don't participate in the judging process is I don't want to be biased and I don't want to go, oh my God, Justin Bieber, kill it.
Yeah, that must be a tough job. It must be a tough gig.
You know, the way I look at it is, I keep myself out of the judging for a reason. You know, I'm there. I'll be there as a tiebreaker. That's my function. You know, my function is let the judges make theirs, let the special judges make the call as to, you know, their votes as to which ones make it into the contest. And then if there's a conflict or something, or if for some reason something happens to break dead, you know, a tie between two videos, then I'll be the tiebreaker. But I try to remove myself from that as much as possible.
Yeah, so. I mean, I know at some smaller cons, the entire thing is judged by like one dude. And I feel bad for that dude.
I do feel bad for that dude. I also kind of feel, I kind of feel bad for the videos though, because, you know, when I don't expect everyone to use the same model we use, but I firmly believe that you want to get, as for your judging anyway, you want to get a fairly broad spectrum, because, you know, I have a lot of people in the judging pool who are really good editors, who are really technically savvy. But then at the same time, I get all others who are like really into the, just the anime and don't know how to beat the technical side of things. So they provide that viewpoint. And then I deliberately go out of my way to get one or two people who are borderline clueless, not clueless in the buoy bubblehead sense of the word, but they're not familiar with a lot of, you know, the details and the minutiae of how this all works together. They're the ones who can just basically go, you know what? I looked at that video. That was a fun video. I enjoyed it. And score it accordingly.
Yeah, it's important to have that gut check, emotional reaction. Exactly. You know, that's important. And the most effective videos give you, you have an emotional response to them. I mean, you know, I've seen very moving anime music videos from time to time. And that's when they're the best, I think.
We also have, to me, the most effective music video is one that, as you said, gives you an emotional reaction. But also, if I can look at one and I can look at a video, in fact, we have a bonus point in our judging system for this. And that is, if you look at the video and it's, say it's an anime you haven't seen, if after watching this video, this AMV makes you look at that anime and go, hey, I really want to go see that. That looks really cool. Or if it's one you've already seen, and that make that the video makes you want to go back and rewatch it, then that's an effective music video, and they get a bonus point for that.
Cool. Okay, so before I let you go here, my final question is: would you ever consider? And I'm sort of begging you to consider banning Weird Al from music video competition.
We don't get a lot of Weird Al entries.
I swear to God, I was at AX, like, I've been to every AX for the last, like, 11 years. Uh-huh. And I think it was 2 years ago, Chase was still around. And I sat in, and, like, three of the comedy videos were Weird Al. And I'm like, this is cheating. This is cheating.
Was it when we were in LA? Because I don't remember.
I think it might have been Long Beach. Okay, it was a while ago.
I was running the contest at that point. That was still under the old directors.
Okay, well, then I'm very happy to hear that he's not a presence so much anymore. That's
although, comfort. You know, I could, there are, he's done some really good stuff. I mean,
I don't have a problem.
Like the idea of seeing White and Nerdy done to Trigun, you know.
I take no issue with Weird Al himself. However, I think it's cheating to do a comedy video with one of his songs.
Fair enough.
All right, man. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about this controversial decision. I wish you best of luck with your experiment and with the show this year.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
All right, thanks a lot, man. See you at AX.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, we are back. Joining me this week is the anime and manga editor for Mania.com, but everybody really knows him as Anime on DVD Honcho, Chris Beveridge. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
And also joining us for this segment, Justin Savakis. Hey, Justin.
Howdy.
So, Chris, before we get into the topic du jour, I want to know, how are things going over at Mania?
Oh, it's good. I mean, we've been keeping up with everything, and the last year had us picking up a lot more of the simulcast arena, so it's been fun having that to deal with. Being a little more timely with what's airing in Japan is a nice change of pace.
Do you think so? Because I noticed that you're working on, like, Saturday afternoon and Sunday more. Like, you're never not working now.
That was true before. You just didn't see it because I was doing the DVDs.
Oh, okay.
So, I was going to say, aren't we?
Well, that's true, but I'll know, like, you're on Twitter talking about how you're watching stuff on Crunchyroll all weekend long, and I'm like, do you take any time off? I guess not.
Well, some of that's the other guys. We use the One Mania account for it. So it's not always just me. Some of the other reviewers are on there.
Oh, well, I'm talking about your Twitter. I'm following you.
It shows up on my Twitter.
Oh, okay.
I'm not watching Rio five times.
God, thank God, your brain would be mush. Okay, so what do you think of the new season? Anything really standing out to you?
It's been all right overall. There's some nice things. The Wandering Sun is visually attractive, but nothing that's like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. I'm not having any, like we had the Sora Nowoto the other year. There was nothing like that that's just jumping out. It's a pleasant season is about all I can say.
Okay. Level E is like the best thing I've seen in a while. I'm really enjoying that show.
It's twisted enough.
Yeah. That's my weird taste, though. we did get a specific request to talk a little bit about Rio. You kind of gave it a pass on its first episode, and I was a little, not really shocked, but a little shocked. I mean, are you still watching that?
Yeah. Yeah, this week's was a little awkward because it's trying to get serious.
Oh, God.
But, I know, it's trying to get a little psychological and everything. But when the show was focused on just being silly, fan service, and you know what I thought was appealing-looking animation and designs, it was fun. You know, when you're watching as many shows as I do, sometimes having something that's just about entertainment is a welcome change of pace.
That is true. I have to take into consideration the sheer amount of media that you have to consume. It's nuts. I thought Rio was one of the most insultingly stupid things I've ever seen in my life, but that's just me. So what, is the future looking good for over at Mania?
Yeah, no problems there. Enjoying it.
That's good. And you're doing a lot more with comics now, right?
Yeah, the comic stuff, movies, gaming, the whole gamut.
So it must be nice to be able to branch out.
Yeah, not having to translate everything first is also a welcome change of pace.
Right, that's good. That's good. Okay, so the real reason we're sort of having you on this week is I wanted to talk a little bit about media collecting. Justin and I are both, Justin much more so than I think, a huge collector of like films. Like we have big libraries of movies and TV shows and stuff. And Chris, you have probably the biggest collection of anime out there, but I noticed you mentioning over time you've changed the way that you collect things. How has that changed for you over the last couple of years?
It's just the thing of where it has grown to be unwieldy. The DVD Blu-ray collection is now up to about 6,500 titles.
Oh my God.
In the basement is where I store them, you know, boxes and numbered and everything, but they're right alongside my comic book collection, which is close to 20,000 issues. And it's just too much. And I've had the slow evolution of what I want out of things.
Right, so that's changed.
Yeah. A lot of it's been just the changes in the economy, you cut back to begin with and you start renting more. So I've been heavily on Netflix, and I buy like a 20th of what I used to for Hollywood movies now.
Really? Is this more like, is it born out of, I'm not going to rewatch this enough to bother buying it and having a physical copy in my house at all times?
Yeah. There comes that realization where you look at what you have. And a lot of it came because of the comic books and the manga was, all right, I have, 200 issues of X-Men. I'm never reading those again. If I am, I'm probably going to pick up the trade. Right. Or I'm going to find some other way of reading it. And the anime fell into the same category.
Well, Chris, I don't know about you, but a big part of my OCD collector's mentality is kind of born of the old school mid-90s, holy cow, I might never find this again sort of thing. And that's just, that's less of a problem with media in general these days.
Yeah, that was one of the other factors. You know, it's like if you're going to find it somewhere, somehow, it'll be out there. Nothing's going to go away anymore is part of it. The value of things is just not there like it used to be.
As anyone who has tried to sell their used DVDs recently can attest to.
To an extent, though, because especially with anime, we're seeing a lot of stuff that's way out of print and you can't find it anywhere. I mean, try to buy Sailor Moon right now. You can't do it. Or you can if you have hundreds and hundreds of dollars. But it's not available. It doesn't exist. And with anime, and we just had Sean Kleckner on talking about this, where stuff goes out of print, you can't get it again. And unless it gets license rescued, good luck, you know?
Right.
So there is an element of that to actually having a physical copy.
Yeah, but you're also coming up with the next generation where they're not looking for physical anymore anyway, so they're not going to be looking to see if there's a tape or a disc or something out there for it.
Yeah. Well, for me personally, this is actually why I buy so much more anime than I buy mainstream Hollywood stuff. I might like a borderline mainstream Hollywood movie just as much as, say, Full Metal Alchemist, but I'll know that when I'm 80, there's still going to be that's still going to be recirculating on cable or whatever we're watching at the time. It's still going to be beamed to whatever smart watch I have at the time. It's just not going to be a problem because there will always be someone trying to make money off of it. With anime, particularly older and more obscure anime, the Japanese, and a lot of this is I can blame on the Japanese copyright system. Some of it's just never going to get reissued in newer formats just because Japan is too much of a horrifying mess of legal rights to ever reissue it in a new format. So I'm like, well, I got to have this and got to have this in the newest possible format because I'm who knows what the future holds.
Yeah, and I think I've downsized my library a little bit over time, and then it builds back up, and then it goes away, and it builds back up and goes away. I go through sort of phases with my collecting, but I still have not, like, Chris, you mentioned Netflix, mm-hmm. and my relationship with Netflix is a little more complicated now because of that window, you know, where it's 30 days, or now they're expanding it to, like, 3 months or something like that, I heard.
Crazy.
Between after theatrical release, the retail release, and then, you know, a month, 3 months later, you can get it in Netflix or Redbox. Does that, I mean, you're a movie fan, does that bug you?
No, because there's so much to watch. You know, I have hundreds of unwatched discs in my collection to begin with, which was part of the problem.
Okay, right.
You know, and I really don't like this idea that Hollywood has of, well, if we refrain from renting it, you're going to buy it. That really doesn't work. If you weren't going to buy it in the first place, you're not going to buy it because you can't get it for 3 months. I just don't think that mentality really works in a significant way.
Well, and my attitude is, if I really want to see the movie, I'll see it in the theater. I'm not going to wait a year, you know, 6 months. If I really want to see the movie, I'll go see the fucking movie. Like, I'm not going to wait that long. You know, and only in the case of, and I'm pretty passionate about this stuff, so I really am curious about virtually everything. So I see a lot of movies in the theaters, but only stuff where I'm kind of meh on it will I actually wait for Netflix. But it's not common. My Netflix queue is mostly, you know, catalog stuff that'll take me 6 months to get around to anyway.
Well, that's kind of the genius of Netflix is that it's basically a pile of stuff we mean to get to.
Yeah.
and it obviously, if it's in our Netflix queue, we clearly aren't feeling strongly enough about it to buy it anyway.
Yeah, and that gives you a new way of looking at how you consume things because it's like what your must-sees become clearer. It's not like, well, I'm going to the movies just because I want to go see something. You see trailers, you add it. The first thing you do when you see a movie trailer you like is add it to your queue just so you don't forget. And it's like, well, it's in my queue. I'm going to get to it at some point, and I've got all these other things to watch.
Right, exactly. So have you thought about getting rid of the collection, or is it where it's at now is where it's going to stay?
Well, pretty much where it is. You know, the Hollywood movies, I add a couple of things, but so much stuff is going to be available on demand in the next few years. The anime stuff, I keep everything because my kids are still growing into it mm-hmm. and discovering shows, so I want to have
especially the hentai.
They haven't gotten there yet. They're getting close, but not yet. They're getting interesting with what they're watching, so you know, it keeps me on my toes there.
Right, and having kids must be a good incentive to keep all that stuff around because you never know when they're going to say, hey, I'm curious about this movie or whatever, and you're like, well, I've got it in the basement.
Yep.
I don't got to wait for Netflix or, you know, plow through my pile in order to get to it. So that, mm-hmm. that can be handy.
But that really only works when you're dealing with anime. When you get out of that arena, there's a lot more availability of stuff. And I do think anime is going to catch up there at some point. Because you're going to have your providers like Crunchyroll that are going to go, look, just give us this stuff, let us put it up, and it'll be there.
A lot of people are really hesitant, though, about the streaming stuff. Because once it goes away, I mean, you guys are talking about, you know, like everything will be available all the time. But those rights do go away, and right now, I believe they yanked down Panty and Stocking with Garter Belt because the arrangement ended. Nobody's mm-hmm. licensed it. The only way you can see that is if you get the fan subs. So what's the solution there? Do they have to extend these contracts out forever? Doesn't that damage the retail life of a product?
The anime stuff just gets so weird with it. For me, you know, I didn't see Panning and Stalking. You know, I'm a fan of their works, but I didn't see this one. I had someone else review it. But I didn't see it, so if it doesn't come out, then I'm just out of luck. And that really doesn't bother me.
Right. Well, you're a special case, though.
I know that makes part of the problem is that I'm in that weird zone, but it's a thing of if I can't see it, that's it. If I can't see it legally, because that's all I do, mm-hmm. I don't go elsewhere looking for anything. And I don't feel that it's owed to me to go and see it.
Right.
Well, also, you watch so much and you're so... there's so much anime in your world that you will never fiend for Panty and Stocking. You will never be... There will probably never be a show to you again that's not a, you know, some Miyazaki or, like, the lost film of Satoshi Kon that he secretly made in his basement. Unless something like that crops up, there's just never going to be that, oh my god, I have to see this right now sort of thing for you.
Right. But I'm like that with all media at this point, because there's so much out there that if it's not available, then there's plenty of other things to move on to.
Do you think that makes you a little ambivalent in your consumption?
To some degree. I mean, the part of it is that there is still so much out there, and I do go through as much of it as I can. But, you know, it's really hard to say on that point.
Well, your reviewing style is very, I don't want to say permissive, but that creeps into your reviews a lot, I think, where it's like, it was pretty good. On to the next thing.
That's where a lot of fans are, too.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah, we had that happen with the number of fans that were watching everything through fan subs for years. And there were a lot of shows that you would have these significant groups that were interested in it and talking about it, and then would get licensed, and then it would fail because it was just a meh kind of show.
Not
so,
yeah.
You know, it's that issue comes up in that way.
ADV.
Well, I'm not trying to say that it's an invalid voice. It's certainly a valid point of view. But I wonder if it dampens enthusiasm or dampens passion for you know, films and anime, and eventually your attitude towards everything gets a little half-lidded.
No, it hasn't with me. There were shows I've really got into in the last season or two. Like Shiki was one I was really into. I got into Hero Man. Beelzebub this season has been really fun. And I still get very enthusiastic about the shows that really stand out.
Right.
It just seems that the ones that do stand out even more because of it.
And that certainly has an impact on your mentality as a collector, that only the stuff that you really respond to is worthy of being in your house all the time.
Right. And that's where the Blu-ray collection comes in for, like, the Hollywood stuff or TV series. Because most TV series are going to be streamed.
Yeah.
You know, movies, there's only the ones that you really want to have, like, the full surround sound, the, you know, zero compression issues and so forth with.
Yeah, that's a big deal. The audio thing I found is a big thing for a lot of people, where they want the Blu-ray specifically because they want the uncompressed audio, and you will not get that from Netflix streaming or anywhere else. So presentation is still an issue. Have you, I should ask, since you are sort of a cutting-edge kind of guy, have you dabbled in the at-home 3D yet?
No, I'm waiting for it to be without glasses. I don't like wearing glasses on top of glasses, if I can help it.
I cannot tell you how unenthusiastic I am to have 3D in my house. Like, I don't care. Justin, I would imagine you're the same way.
Oh, God. I don't like it in the theater. The only time where I felt it ever added anything was for Avatar.
Yeah.
It was really, really good in the Justin Bieber movie I saw this weekend.
I'm sure.
It really actually was.
You're lucky you have kids, Chris. So in terms of bringing home a collection, do you find yourself combing through it a lot? Do you catalog and organize everything, or is it at this point just kind of, well, it's in the basement and there it sits?
No, it's all cataloged. I know what box everything is in, because I do go through and pull stuff out from a girlfriend who hasn't seen a lot of these movies. She's been very deprived over the years from Hollywood.
Okay.
So being able to grab things out has been easily done. I don't really go through looking for anything because I can't bring myself to watch DVD movies I own anymore.
Oh, really? Okay.
But I'm all caught up on my Blu-ray, so it's easy in that regard.
Yeah, I have to say, a lot of the older stuff, and this drives me crazy, is that almost every DVD that came out before 2003 or so looks like ass today.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, this drives me crazy with, like, especially some of the older anime DVDs that just never came out here, or that were never re-released, rather. Especially from, like, early ADV and most of CPM's catalog. Even Hollywood movies, too. Like, before they just announced the Blu-ray of this, I had a hankering to watch Awakenings with, Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. I rented it on Netflix, and it's this sad, sad DVD that doesn't even have a custom menu. It looks like someone made it with a set-top recorder.
Oh, God. Taped it off TBS or something.
And, like, if that's the only thing that's available, and in a lot of cases it is, it's just, it just kind of makes me want to, start stabbing myself. Just take the knife and start cutting like a 13-year-old girl.
Right. Chris, how quickly do you replace your DVDs when the Blu-ray becomes available? Are you real adamant on that, or is it, my rule is, if I feel like watching it again, then I go buy the Blu-ray.
Very, very few. My upgrade path has been maybe one or two discs a year at most.
Really?
It's really like the big things, like, Star Wars, I'll upgrade. The original Tron, I'll upgrade just because I want the new set anyway. But most movies, I find myself in the position of, like, well, I own it on DVD. I haven't watched it in 6 or 10 years, like the Kubrick collection stuff. It's just as easy to search for it on the TiVo, on a pay channel that I already have. Odds are it's already been in HD there, and it may not be Blu-ray, but it's better than a DVD I have.
Wow, okay. So
I may just go and rent it. I just don't. I'm not double dipping anymore outside of certain really key properties that are just ones that I want to watch over and over and share with people.
Give us an example of one of those.
Like the Star Wars set is one that I'll be doing.
Right.
The Star Trek movies I upgraded. Things like that. You know, the really eye popping things.
So the classics that you tend to revisit once a year, anyway.
Yeah, stuff that I know I have an established relationship with.
Yeah, it's kind of the same for me. I have a ton of DVDs that I bought really cheap that I just don't feel like upgrading ever, even if I do want to watch them again. Like, I got the DVD of 8 Mile for 75 cents. I was like, yeah, I kind of like that movie. I never need to own the Blu-ray of that.
And most of them are not things you're going to say, oh, I need to watch this right now. I can just throw it into Netflix or something, and I'll have it in a day or two.
Right. Like, if it's a seminal movie that means a lot to me, like, for instance, Network is coming out on Blu-ray, that I'm pre-ordering.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, one downside to switching over to Blu-ray that I've encountered is the inability to take screenshots. I participate in a couple of stupid little games on some forums where they do a guess the movie based on the obscure screenshot game. And I can't play that anymore because you can't take screen caps of Blu-rays unless you go through this really obnoxious process of or like take a photo of your TV or whatever. And the it's not as versatile in terms of doing what I would want to do with a film, like occasionally take a screenshot or take it on the road if I'm traveling and want some movies to watch. It's not as versatile a product, and I've run into that a couple of times.
That's more of a software issue, though, than anything.
That is very true. Justin, you just wrote an article on how Blu-ray is kind of broken.
one of my pet peeve topics. Yeah, this wasn't for Anna, and this is for my new seldom-traveled blog, MediaOCD.com. But yeah, there was I basically just had to rant because Blu-ray was made, and the format was ratified when they were really trying to push it out to compete with HD DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't done. And it's still not done. And because players shipped with the not done spec, probably about half of the features that Blu-ray officially supports, it doesn't support and no one can take advantage of because it's just broken. For example, it's supposed to be able to render text. you know, it would be great to like, oh, cool, I can download, you know, a new subtitle track or something like that, or, you know, annotations, or, you know, there's a whole interactive thing where I can browse this half website thing from the disk. None of that can work because the players have no built-in fonts and no ability to do anti-aliasing or proper kerning or anything else we take for granted with text. So it would look like butt.
They'll get it with the next format.
Whatever the next thing is.
It's called the web.
Yeah. So, Chris, I wanted to ask, in terms of your collection, when it comes to anime, how often do you revisit anything?
That's maybe a couple times a year at best, and it's usually just the big things like a Ghibli movie or a particular show I want to show someone who hasn't seen anything before.
Okay, but it's in terms of anime consumption for you, it is a full steam ahead, moving forward, not looking back kind of a thing.
Unless it's a re-release that comes through, and then I'm like, oh, I'll watch that again. I haven't seen it in 6 or 7 years.
Right.
That's the only time but it's a very different experience doing that compared to how I did it in the early part of the decade. Because that was 3 to 4 episodes a disc, you know, every 2 months, as opposed to watching all 26 in the space of 2 days.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's improved a lot of shows over the years from how I felt about them the first time around, and weakened others.
And are you taking advantage of any of the digital, like, you know, iPad stuff or reading comics or watching shows on a portable device?
Yeah, I'm big on comics with the iPad. I've been promoting that heavily advocating for it since it came out last year.
Who do you think is doing it right?
I can't get enough of it.
Who do you think is doing it right?
I've used all the different apps for it on the iPad, and the Comixology is the one that I keep stepping behind and saying it's the best one out there. The reading format alone makes it easy. It handles the shift of, you know, the direction of everything. It has a nice smooth flow. It just works. It feels like you're reading a comic and just swiping along instead. The other ones make a little bit more of a show of how it's boxed in and everything. And their stores just don't work as well. They just feel like they're kludges overall. This one is one that feels like professional and smooth.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, I'm about to get into this stuff myself, and I'm really curious about it. And that's obviously a much more preferable way for you to consume, especially single issue comics.
Yeah.
Over having to go to the store every Wednesday.
Yeah, I've been on trades for the last several years. I mean, I've been reading comics since like the 3rd or 4th issue of Star Wars came out in the 70s.
Okay.
And I just couldn't handle it anymore buying singles, especially with the pricing. But the only downside that they have right now is that a lot of the books are not same day. So you're dealing with stuff that's a year or so behind, but you're paying half the price.
Right, and obviously the weight doesn't bug you.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Now, do you still, of any of your collections, do you still have anything out for display, or is it all in boxes in the basement?
Everything's pretty much in boxes except for the to-watch pile.
How big is that?
It's not too bad. It's made up of a bunch of TV series boxes right now I need to get to.
Okay.
But it's not just me watching it. I have to watch it with my girlfriend, and she's a little not as consuming as I am.
Right.
I have to say, I think the display shelf thing is, although it's cool for some people, it's also a barrier to a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of the people that it's a barrier to, mostly because I've lived my entire life in a, you know, urban setting in a tiny apartment. So, you know, I cannot add any more shelves. I just don't have room.
Yeah, I used to have custom bookshelves at my last house that I had did articles on and everything. And we did all kinds of things over the years with, you know, how to store your stuff and how to display it and everything. And it's too much. I can't do it. That's part of the shift in just wanting all digital. I don't want to own it anymore. I just want to watch it.
If you had the chance to turn your entire physical library into just a hard drive, would you do it?
Yeah, if I could play it anywhere I wanted.
Right.
That's the limiting factor.
So in your dream world, you've got a big mainframe in the basement with 8,000 movies and anime series on it. You plug your iPod in or your iPad in, and then you go on a trip or whatever.
Yeah, it plays to the PS3, it plays on the TiVo, or direct to the TV with the way they're working now with all the widgets on those. You know, I can watch what I have that I've purchased wherever I want.
Justin, are you thinking the same way?
I've actually done research.
Okay.
I've toyed with this kind of, you know, I've been kind of fantasizing about this for a while. I probably wouldn't do this to the Blu-rays yet, but definitely the DVDs, and just have by like a, you know, 10 terabyte Drobo, and just have them all on a local server and transcode everything to MPEG-4 format that plays in everything. Yep. You know, get play it on the home theater PC in the living room, the boxy in the bedroom, the iPhone, whatever, if I want to take it on the road. That I think I'm almost there. The problem is we're still talking about like $500 or $600 to put all that together at minimum, probably closer to $1,000 if I wanted to get enough storage. And really the bigger problem is it is going to be so painful and boring ripping 1,500 discs.
Yep. That's just 1,500.
Right, you're not dealing with 7,000 or whatever it is that Chris has got.
Well, on the plus side, I imagine a good percentage of your collection, Chris, you're just never going to want to watch again.
Yeah, but you never know. That's the thing. You want to sit there and go, hey, I'd like to watch an episode of this and just be able to queue it up.
Well, yeah, but you probably have Slayers down there.
I've watched Slayers. I like Slayers now.
What?
I've rewatched it. I spent one week last year. Seriously, I spent one week watching all three seasons day after day until I finished it all.
Is this one of those things I have to look forward to as part of having kids?
They haven't watched it. Don't worry. They're not going to watch it. Getting into it again with them. But no, like I said, things change over the years. I mean, we all watch, as much as we watch movies and TV shows and everything else, our view of what we like, what entertains us, changes as we get older.
Well, yeah, but most people, as they get older, find that they just hate everything they used to like. It doesn't usually go the other direction.
Oh, that's not the way to live, though. I can't live like that.
I don't know. I mean, with anime, the stuff that I really, really loved in the 90s, I still like. I mean, it's not like I hate all that stuff now.
Tenchi.
Maybe Tenchi. I mean, I don't hate Slayers, but looking back on it, it wasn't worth the enthusiasm I had for it back then, but I was a teenager, you know. But I don't think anything that I watched back then that I thought was kind of meh, I would go back to now and say like, oh, wow, why didn't I give this thing a fair shake?
I'm pretty sure if you, as part of your job, had to rewatch all of Slayers now, I'll bet you would develop a quite searing hatred for it.
Oh, I'm sure. But I have different standards now for what I find entertaining. This happens as you age. Right. But going back to the whole the library question or going straight digital, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, but I still like having my shelf of movies, and I still like holding the physical copy in my hand. I still like, you know, getting the fancy slipcover. I still like all that stuff. That's still important to me. I like the experience of, on Tuesday, driving over to Best Buy to buy a movie I've been waiting to come out. You know, I like doing that. I like going shopping, and I especially like buying movies, so I don't know, the thought of just having a mainframe in my house that I just pull stuff off of seems like kind of a cold experience. Like, it's not warm like going to the movie theater and seeing all the new posters and stuff. And I'm sure that's just nostalgia, but I still like that.
You'll find you might go through that change like I did, where it's just the thing of you just want to have the experience of the show or the book. You know, like I did that with e-readers a couple years ago. I got into those. And I don't buy paper books. I haven't bought them for a couple of years. There's just no interest in that. And there's a lot of love from people who love the experience of having a book in hand.
You know, the physicality of certain media formats is something that can really mean a lot to people. It becomes a part of the experience of watching something. I mean, I used to have that with Laserdisc. the whole thing of taking out this giant heavy platter and lowering it gently into that giant tray and watching it gingerly slide in, that was cool. And I miss that. I do. I don't get the same feeling from any of the smaller disc formats, and so I can easily dismiss that experience by, you know, if other people, if that's what they grew up with, I could understand why that would be a thing.
And once you get past that experience, it's a whole different perspective. One of the things I did that got me past it was, because I had so many discs, I needed a better way of storing them. I was thin packing everything. I was cutting covers. And slicing them up and putting them in, you know, smaller cases.
Yeah, after you blogged about that, I followed your lead. And
yeah, and once you do that, you kind of disconnect a little bit from the importance of the physicality.
I kind of regret doing that, do you?
No, because I'm never going to sell them. You know, at most, I might give them to a library someday, or they're just going to sit in my basement until something happens.
I did sell a few, and nobody noticed the you know, slightly trimmed covers, but I feel the experience did break something, because I blew probably $250 on thin pack cases, and all to kind of preserve a filing system that just didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of work, a lot of effort. I had to buy a big paper cutter from Staples, and it's all to and you know, for what? I ended up throwing them all away when I moved here. You know, I have all my DVDs in you know, DJ flight cases now, and all the inserts are filed in a file box, and that's kind of the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, what's your filing system?
I use the extra long comic boxes stacked on top of each other.
Okay.
So you get like two rows in each box. I don't know how many I fit in each one.
So you keep the cases?
Yeah, they're just thinned.
Do you still thin everything?
Most things. The only things I don't are like the double disc sets now, because they're in a single size keep case. There's not that much savings for it, for most of the anime being done that way. And most of the anime is out in thin pack cases now anyway.
Yeah, the Funimation doing the, you know, four discs in a single DVD case all stacked sort of awkwardly on top of each other. I'm not sure I really like those cases. Bandai put out one that was a single size DVD case that had like 9 discs in it.
I think like the Clamp School Detectives was like that.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I opened it up, I'm like, you're kidding me.
This was ridiculous.
I do have to marvel at the feats of engineering that can cram that many discs into such a small space.
Yep.
Yeah, but they're always kind of broken. There's always pieces of plastic floating around in inside whenever those wind up coming in the mail.
But the discs play, and that's where I keep coming back to. They play, and I don't have any problem.
Yeah,
I have to say, it's very freeing to not care about broken hubs and stuff anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you all remember back in the early part of the decade when people would flip the fuck out if their, you know, Please Teacher Volume 2 had a busted hub.
The good old days.
Yeah.
Or just arguing violently about the different kinds of hubs.
Damn those Scanavos.
I remember, I don't know if you guys remember this, but when Gladiator first came out on DVD, a lot of my friends broke their copies of it because the hub was really poorly designed. And you have to, like, you've all encountered the hub where you have to, like, practically bend the disc in half to get it off.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So many people. They're like, I broke my copy. I just bought this. It was $30, you know.
That was a real problem. I mean, there was this one kind of hub that seemed fairly okay. It was kind of an elaborate hinge where the hub was a button that you pushed in. I had that actually kind of shred the top layer of a lot of the hubs of my DVDs. I had to put a sticker over them just to make sure they didn't break any further.
Wow.
That was a bummer. I have a couple discs that are pretty rare that the top shredded because of a stupid hub.
Speaking of rarity, have either of you guys encountered a situation where, especially in terms of like just a movie, not necessarily anime, where, I know, Chris, you mentioned you're ambivalent about this, so it doesn't really matter, but have you ever seen, like, you were really dying to see one particular movie, and for whatever reason it was out of print, you couldn't rent it, you couldn't find it anywhere? Has that ever happened to you?
I'm finding it now just because of the rental thing. Criterion stuff doesn't always show up on Netflix, so I'm sitting and waiting and waiting and waiting.
Yeah, it's going to be even more rare when that contract expired.
Yeah.
I'm in love with obscure and, you know, foreign films, so that happens to me a lot, particularly with like mainland Chinese movies. That tends to either show up almost never, or if it shows up, it's like a terrible, terrible dark transfer that you can barely make out.
Yeah, there's actually, with foreign movies, man, you can get some really bummer DVDs, like really shitty, where just clearly didn't care.
I'm working on a review of this one that was put out by Facets. It's this Italian movie from 1980. And I'm seriously convinced that this is one of those hard subtitled VHS masters that I could literally see someone with those ancient 1985 era Chirons just hitting appear, disappear, appear, disappear. It just looks like ass, and I'm just like, oh, I want to remake this DVD, but I don't know how I would ever do that.
To somehow track down the original elements. I have to admit, I've taken advantage of that. I did sell my copy of the original Tron for like $70. So, I mean, I've taken advantage of that from time to time, but I think with the Criterion stuff, it's the only time I've ever been like, wow, I really want to see this movie, and the Criterion's been out of print, and no one has the rights to it anymore, and you can't find it anywhere. And so that's a scenario where I wish I'd have bought it when it came out, and I wish I had a physical copy in my house.
When I was at CPM, because I was so broke because they were paying me so crappy, I was selling a lot of the DVDs that I worked on that I got free copies of. And then I've gone, man, I wish I had a copy of that. I worked on that. That happened recently with me with Nightwalker.
Oh, yeah.
Which actually isn't a bad show.
That's not available at all anymore, right?
Oh, nope. No. In fact, those discs are so rare. I was looking for a couple of years before I found Volume 2.
Oh, jeez. Wow. Chris, do you have any particularly rare things in your collection? I mean, obviously, probably every anime released between 2000 and 2009 or whatever.
No, not that I can really think of that I know of, you know, unless you count, like, the old Bandai Visual USA stuff, because, you know, they didn't make any of those.
Right. I mean, like 400 or something like that.
Except for the Pat Labors, there's still millions of those floating around out there.
Yeah, but a lot of that Oniyama stuff, for whatever weird reason, the Fry's Electronics here has a big stack of Wings of Oniyama on DVD, mm-hmm. on Blu-ray and on HD DVD, and they're all still marked like $70 or something like that. There's a big dusty pile of them. But a lot of those releases, I don't think you can really find them anymore. They put out some pretty obscure stuff.
Yeah, stuff that just didn't sell either, so they didn't print a lot of them.
You mean you don't have a copy of Demon Prince Enma?
I do.
Well, you do. I know you do.
I know you mentioned you were enjoying Wandering Sun, but we haven't talked to you in about a year. So I'm curious, like, what from the last year or so would you say, hey, everybody run out and see this?
The only one that really comes to mind that is like a must see, and I almost say a must own, is The Garden of Sinners. That release just completely blew me away.
Too bad you can't buy it.
Yep, exactly. So now what are you going to do?
Did you buy that?
No, I didn't. I couldn't afford it. Right. But, you know, but it was gorgeous.
Yeah, I thought that's one of those releases where I wish anime fans had an opportunity to see it legally. And they don't now. They had a very brief window where they could have paid out the ass for it. But
it's no different than everything else Japan puts out.
Yeah, right.
So.
Right. Well, I don't know. That's pretty. $600 is pretty expensive for for anything, even in Japan. That's a premium. That's a premium price.
Mm-hmm. I can't. I don't. What's the most you've ever paid for anything?
That would probably go back to the Urusei Yatsura Laserdisc box set.
How much?
$400.
Oh, Jesus!
And it's set in a huge, huge plastic case. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No, I've never seen that.
I'll see if I can pull my copy on and show you guys sometimes. But it's just. You never saw anything like it, because they didn't know how to package 10 discs back then.
If I remember, they didn't know how to package 3 discs back then. Remember how Bubblegum Crisis first came out in a software box?
The DVD for that. Oh.
God, that was horrible. It's just like a jewel case and a big empty cardboard box. Man, that was awful. I remember that. I think the most expensive thing I bought lately was the Alien Anthology on Blu-ray, which I paid $100 for. Worth every penny, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, geez, I don't know. I think I paid like $80 for my copy of the Mystery Science Theater 20th Anniversary box, which, again, worth every penny. But I haven't bought a lot of super premium releases. Certainly nothing in the $400. I mean, if you add everything up, sure, I've spent a hell of a lot of money on Blu-rays, but not any one particular item. What about you, Justin?
I think the most expensive thing I ever bought was the that big fuzzy box, Laserdisc box set of Memories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, three discs, import, but it had English subtitles on closed captioning. And I was so happy to get it. I still have it because it came with a bunch of nice printed stuff. But yeah, I've since rebought that movie 3 or 4 times. But yeah, $120, $130 is usually my cutoff point. I just spent that on the out of print region 2 of Dominion Tank Police.
Oh wow! Okay.
That's another one of those where CPM's DVD of that was so horrible that every time I popped it in, it just kind of drove me crazy.
Well, to add on to that most expensive thing, what movie do you think you've bought the most number of times?
Oh God, I can't even think of that. It's probably some of the Disney movies.
Oh yeah, well, those have had like 8 re-releases.
Yeah, or close to them would be like the Ghibli movies, because I would get the Laserdisc, I would get the import DVD when that came out, and then the US DVD.
And now the Blu-rays of those.
That's why I didn't buy the Japanese Blu-rays this time. I'm like, I know they're coming out here. I can wait.
I only bought Nausicaa because I really liked the cover design. And I knew we would get some piece of key art.
I think mine is either Memories or... might be Wings of Onyamis. I think I bought that 4 times.
On what, VHS, DVD?
VHS, Laserdisc, manga video, crappy DVD, and then the Blu-ray.
Wow. Okay. I think it's just Star Wars. I think I've bought that in every incarnation it's had so far, which would be like 4 or 5. But I never had Laserdiscs. I was a little, I don't want to say too young for that, because Justin's a little bit younger than me, but, I never had them.
Any extremely, exceedingly rare stuff that you're just really, really proud that you've managed to snap up a copy of?
The only thing I really think of is, like, I still have those Sailor Moon sets.
Have you looked at eBay lately on those?
No.
You probably put the girls through college with those.
Season 2 by itself, that ADV release with the trash can audio, season 2 by itself goes for $350.
I can't retire yet, so I'll hold on to it.
Yeah, if anybody ever...
My retirement fund.
I mean, well, like, this, I was looking at it just the other day because I was curious, like, wow, how much are people paying for Sailor Moon? Because it hasn't been available for anyone for years. Even, like, the single release, like, the dub-only episodes, even, like, the singles for those go for, like, $25. And if you have the Genion releases, those go for $50, $60, $70 each. It's kind of nuts.
It's amazing, but, you know, I think I am quite sure that, you know, the comic book store owners and, you know, specialty collector shops like that, you know, they see how rare something is and they price it like that. I really wonder if they actually sell for those prices.
I looked at closed auctions.
Never mind.
Yeah, it's Cardcaptor Sakura is going to be that way pretty soon too, unless somebody decides to re-release it. That's another one that goes for a lot of money. Yeah. In terms of rare, I have that Escaflowne box set where it's all 8 discs in a special box, and it comes with a little black robot,
Gaimalef
or whatever the hell they're called. Yeah, I have that. That's probably the only like collector's edition thing that I have that you probably can't buy anywhere anymore. That I'm happy I have it, but at the same time, like, I've made terrible decisions buying collector's edition packaging, and it eats up space. I eventually grow to hate them. Like, I bought that Harry Potter trunk.
Oh, God.
Which is the stupidest thing I ever did, because it's huge. I have to keep it outside of the shelf because it takes up too much space otherwise. The spines aren't displayed. I can't put any of the other movies in it because they won't fit. It's just the worst idea.
Yeah, I'm so happy I never bought a Gantz ball.
Oh, yeah. They sent one of those to Bamboo. I think she still has it in a box somewhere. I would imagine, Chris, that kind of thing was the first thing off your list in terms of not coming into my house. Big bulk.
I sold a lot of them, though, when I worked the table for a bit.
Oh, yeah?
I pushed those hard. They were just fun to sell.
I have to admit, I ended up throwing out a lot of my chipboard boxes.
Really?
And which I felt really bad about, because I know some people, you know, would... you know, cry blood out their eyes for them, but I'm just like, I have no space for these, I don't know what to do with them, and I have no use for them. I saved a couple, but most of them, trash.
Jeez, you could have sold those. People buy them.
I really wonder.
Well, no, you could, because look at Blu-ray collectors. If you save your slipcases, you can sell them for like $5 a piece. People are fanatics about it.
Yep. Well, some I kept, but, you know, the take the folded cardboard box of for like Legend of Himiko. Uh-huh. What was, who's really going to buy that?
Someone.
There's a fan.
You probably that's only get part. You probably only get $6 for it, but yeah. All right, well, I think that's a good place to put a button on this. Chris, thanks so much for coming by, and it's fun to, it's always fun to chat with you. So, you know, best of luck over it. Keep the unbelievable media consumption train moving.
Somebody has to do it.
All right, I'm sure you're looking forward to spring.
Oh yeah, new season. Let's start again from scratch.
Yes, let's. All right, dude. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Take it easy.
Okay, everybody, that's our show. I want to thank Michael and Chris for joining me this week. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and hey, see you next week.